Hello, this is Lois Pausch reading the Vermillion County News for Friday, July the 14th. And we start off with an article with the headline, "We Have Liftoff. 2017 Balloons Event Begins with the Splash and Dash." Dateline Danville. Hot air balloon pilot Walt Rudy may have traveled all the way from Wandsworth, Ohio, for this year's Balloons Over Vermillion event, but to him, flying around Danville is like coming home. Rudy was just one of about a dozen hot air balloons that participated in this year's Splash and Dash, an event associated with the Danville Boat Club, where balloon pilots aim to splash their balloon down on Lake Vermillion and throw a rubber duck as close as possible to a designated target. Championing the event is quite a challenge, as balloon piloting takes much skill and planning, especially when charting a path over a certain location. "Some events, they tell us how far out we have to go," Rudy said. "They don't care if we go further out, but they want us to be a certain distance from it, a mile or 3 miles. Rudy's a commercial pilot with about 33 years of experience flying balloons, which include over 1,000 flight hours. Originally from Rantoul, he said he'd fly back in the day in Danville with the Oldsmobile Classic balloon event. He also flew in last year's Balloons Over Vermillion. Rudy says it's absolutely a family experience. It's family and friends," he added. "There are a lot of generational pilots, kids who grew up with ballooning who went on to get their pilot's license and fly. One of his sons still helps crew with him," he said. "Some kids get into it, some don't. It's certainly a spectacle that attracts the young and old." Before landing, his balloon passed by an ongoing softball game at Winter Park, and a group of children and some parents followed him over as he touched down. Wide-eyed and curious, the kids approached the balloon before the sound of the burner blasting off sent a few running. One said he could probably roast marshmallows from the heat. As the balloon envelope fell to the ground, Rudy told the children they could touch it but not walk on it. "There's a lot kids can learn from hot air balloons," according to Rudy. "There's a lot of history to it," he said, "and it teaches them how to relate to people and a lot of teamwork. It's definitely a team sport. There's no way to get around that." And the next is an article with the headline, "Children Experience Nature at Kennicott, Dateline Danville." A dozen children experienced nature up close Thursday morning when they hiked the Lookout Point Trail at Kennicott County Park, north of Danville, before they embarked on their outdoor adventure to look for bugs and other critters as part of the Wonder Bugs program for kindergartners through second graders. The children made crafts and learned about trees inside the Vermillion County Conservation District's Environmental Education Center. 6-year-old Madeline Rambold took her time putting the finishing touches on her wooden salamander that she painted solid green before placing it with the other colorfully painted salamanders to dry. Next, environmental educator Lara Darling brought out a box of wooden tree trunk slices of varying diameters and asked the children, "How can you tell how old a tree is?" Equipped with magnifying glasses, each child counted the growth rings on the tree trunk slices. Darling then asked the youngsters to draw a picture of the number of tree rings that correspond to their age. Darling moved on to another tree question, asking the children, "How do trees grow?" "It starts growing little by little," 4-year-old Lily Solomon offered. Darling explained to the children that trees start out as a seed and shared many different examples: walnuts, chestnuts, locust seed pods, sweet gum balls, pine cones, and even the more unfamiliar Kentucky coffee tree seed pods. Children rolled the large walnuts on tables and smelled the coffee-like scent of the Kentucky coffee tree seed pod, though some thought it smelled more like tea or even rotten eggs. The spiky outer layer of the chestnut tree seed pod intrigued the children as each one took turns touching it. "So if you crack it open, there's a seed inside?" 6-year-old Sawyer Billings inquired. Darling said both the chestnut and sweet gum pods prickly outside keep the seed safe inside from being eaten by animals. And the next article has the headline, "Committee Discusses Route 1 Traffic." Dateline Daniel, initial analysis of North Vermillion Street / Route 1 traffic through between Voorhees Street and Winter Avenue shows only about 18% of traffic being commercial, going through and leaving the area. The majority of traffic is local, said Danville Engineering and Urban Services Director David Schnelly. Danville Area Transportation Study Policy Committee members received updates on the Bowman Corridor Study and other projects on Thursday. As a bypass, officials are looking at how much traffic could be predicted to go to Bowman Avenue with improvements, Schnelly said. It's too difficult to navigate, Bowman, Schnelly said, adding that Vermillion Street is a train-free way to go up Route 1. The Bowman Avenue Corridor Study is to identify issues and opportunities along the Bowman Avenue corridor from route from Interstate 74 to the northern limits of the metropolitan planning area. The study also to evaluate east-west connections and needed improvements, determine the potential for Illinois Route 1 traffic congestion relief, and evaluate the impact on residential and commercial areas along Route 1 from Interstate 74 to West Newell Road. The next phase is designing alternatives for Bowman and Route 1 and public outreach and dialogues. The committee also discussed Danville City staff working on an Americans with Disabilities Act transition plan, which has city government conduct self-evaluations of current facilities, programs, policies, and practices to determine what changes are necessary to meet the ADA's requirements. A transition plan helps implement changes. Schnelly said they anticipate putting the ADA plan on public display within the coming month and then taking it to the Danville City Council for approval. The committee on Thursday also approved a 2018-2021 Transportation Improvement Plan, which includes Webster Street sidewalk work in Catlin, Voorhees Street bridge replacement over Stony Creek, roundabout at English and Jackson Streets, Denmark Road and Northwest Pump Station, and some bridge replacements in the county, and bridge replacements and repairs with the Illinois Department of Transportation in addition to Interstate 74 reconstruction from U.S. 150 west of Danville to the Middle Fork Vermillion River. Schnelly also added that with a state budget in place, work was resumed on the Danville High School shared use path work. DAT's Technical Committee Chairman Doug Stasky also said the Catlin-Homer Road Bridge project will be starting July 31st. There will be one lane traffic. And now we go to the obituaries. And the first is for Frances Mildred Birch Milliken. Frances Mildred Birch Milliken, 83, of Kingman, died on Monday, July 10th at Union Hospital in Clinton while surrounded by her loving family. Family will receive friends from 4 to 8 p.m. on Friday, July 14th at Sanders Funeral Home, 203 South 1st Street in Kingman. Funeral service will be Saturday, July 15th at 11 a.m. at the funeral home with Pastor Don Hatfield officiating. Burial will follow at Kingman Fraternal Cemetery. And the next is for Norman G. Mullins, 84, of Rossville, formerly of Georgetown, who died at 3:30 a.m. Wednesday at Watsika Healthcare, Watsika. A celebration of Norman's life will be held at 12 p.m. Friday, July 14th at Sunset Houghton Leisure Funeral Home, 200 East West Street, Georgetown, with Richard Huber officiating. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to noon on Friday prior to his service at the funeral home. He will be laid to rest in McKendry Cemetery. Memorial donations may be given in his name to the Danville Humane Society. And the next is for Ramona Ann Osborne, 69, a resident of the waters of Covington and formerly of Kingman, Indiana, who died at 5:56 a.m. Wednesday, July 12th at Franciscan Health Lafayette East in Lafayette, Indiana. Cremation was accorded. A private family visitation will be held at a later date. And now, this is an article, and it has the title, or this is a column, Walk Away from the Toxic Relationship with Your Mother. Dear Annie, I'm a 40-something divorced mother of two and grandmother of five. I have wonderful relationships with my children and grandchildren. Sadly, the name cannot be said of my relationship with my mother. This woman has not liked me since the time I was a teenager. Although I was not perfect, I was not a rebellious teen and did well in school and sports. I always tried to be respectful of authority. When I became engaged to my now ex-husband, my mother made her hatred for me even more noticeable. She despised the fact that my partner's family members were God-fearing, church-going Christians. She even refused to attend my wedding. Needless to say, I was heartbroken. She will not acknowledge my children or grandchildren. She has been married several times and is married to a wonderful man. She does not treat my siblings this way. Annie, I would do anything for this woman. I've tried to talk to her about this, but she always says that I'm the horrible one, that she has done nothing wrong, and that nowhere is it written that a mother has to love her daughter. My friends and family tell me that she doesn't deserve my love, that the relationship is toxic, and that I should just let it go. Do I walk away or still try to fight for something that most likely will never happen? Motherless in the Midwest. Dear Motherless, it is in fact written that a mother should love her children, and in the best-selling book of old times, no less, the Bible. Your friends and family are right that her behavior is toxic and that the best thing for you to do would be to distance yourself. It will always be hard, but your head must be a friend to your heart and keep reminding it of the truth. I'm sorry she's been so cruel to you. It's truly her loss. For all the love and warmth your mother hasn't shown you, you seem to have made up for it in spades with your children and now your grandchildren. Focus on those mother-daughter relationships, which will bring your heart joy for years to come. And now another letter. Dear Annie, I read the column with a letter from Needing a Break in Pensacola, whose siblings seem to expect him or her to always look after their mother. I went through this when my mom had a stroke that had her bedridden. Every 6 weeks or so, when I could put together a week off work, I drove 500 miles to stay a week with her and my dad to help out. One trip, my husband came with me, and we did all sorts of helpful things for Mom and Dad. Several of my siblings were there, too. My husband and I took one day just for ourselves, and when we returned at day's end, the siblings acted as if we had done something awful. You're right. Caregivers must look after themselves or they will be of no help to anyone. Been there too. Dear, been there too. Thank you for sharing your experience. I'm printing it here so Needing and any other caregivers who have been similarly guilt-tripped will know they are not alone. Okay, and now some sports news. And the article says, Positive Outlook, Dan's Rally, Fall in Extra Innings to Rex. Dateline Danville, no team has ever wanted to lose. But some losses can actually turn into positive outcomes. On Thursday night, the Danville Dans proved they could overcome a six-run deficit, along with an unfortunate situation in the seventh inning, to force extra innings. But it wasn't a completely positive night for the home team, as the Terre Haute Rex scored twice in the tenth inning to beat the Dans 9-7. "We battled back," said Danville manager Eric Coleman. "We dug ourselves a hole, but we still got the game into extra innings. They got two runs, and we still came back to get the tying runs on base. We just didn't execute at the end and get the job done. It's a new day tomorrow. We will come back to work and get ready to play Springfield." Danville second baseman Jim Govern capped the rally for the Dans with a sacrifice fly in the eighth inning to tie the game at 7-7. "With this offense, we can come back from any deficit," said Govern, who went 2-for-5. "We proved that tonight, but it's also nice to score first and play with the lead." Actually, Govern's eighth inning sacrifice fly could have been a game winner for Danville, who are 20-19, if one unfortunate situation in the seventh inning would have gone his team's way. With the bases loaded in Danville trailing 6-2, first baseman Michael Rothmund blasted a ball into the right center field gap. Tucker Cascaden and Don Gardner, who started the inning with back-to-back singles, scored easily, and Govern tried to score from first. Terre Haute catcher Jared O'Leary got the relay throw from shortstop Joe Boyle just as Govern reached the plate area. O'Leary attempted a tag but appeared to bobble the ball, and Govern missed the plate. Both players seemingly realized the play was still live as Govern dove for the plate and O'Leary dove to make the tag. Home plate umpire Tony Monteleone Sr. called Govern out as both Govern and Coleman argued vehemently. "I was safe 100%, said Govern, admitting that he probably should have been thrown out of the game. "He missed me on the first attempt, and then on the second one, I got my hand to the plate before he tagged my shoulder." But Monteleone had a different interpretation to Coleman. "It was a bang-bang play, and I'm always going to send him in that situation," Coleman said. "They made a good relay throw, but I still think he was safe. The umpire was late to call it, but he said that he tagged him first time and then he waited to call it after he goes around the plate. Didn't he see O'Leary bobble the ball? That's what I said," Coleman said. "He bobbled the baseball. It is what it is." There are lots of things in that game that could have happened and didn't go our way. Terre Haute scored both of its runs in the 10th inning without the benefit of a hit, and the only hit in the entire frame was an infield chopper by Tucker Greer to begin the inning. Gilberto Millo was credited with the game-winning RBI as he was hit by a pitch with the bases loaded and after a pair of strikeouts. Terre Haute, 19-20, increased its lead on the bases loaded walk to Joe Boyle as it appeared that Monteleone was going to call strike two instead of ball four. "You can't be flinching at this level," Coleman said. Danville's last chance in the bottom of the 10th got started the right way. Chris Colarossi and Alec Barger, batting 7th and 8th respectively, got back-to-back singles. Cascaden advanced them into scoring position with a perfectly executed sacrifice bunt. He also had a perfectly executed hit and run play to get those two in scoring position in the 8th to go along with his two hits in the contest. "Tucker puts in the work," Coleman said. "It's nice to see some balls bouncing his way, and he's had some good, really good at-bats. There is a reason why he plays in the Big 12 Conference." But Terre Haute's Ethan Howard, making just his second appearance of the summer, struck out Gardner and got Govern to ground out to end the game. Danville's rally started in the 6th inning when Bubba Monasmith blasted a 2-run homer to left field. Monasmith went 3-for-5 in the contest and was just a triple shy of hitting for the cycle. And this is another news article with the headline, "Illinois Strategy for Digging Out of Debt, Taking on More." Dateline Springfield. Illinois lawmakers, who recently ended the longest fiscal standoff of any state since the Great Depression, are counting on an ironic strategy to dig out of mountains of debt, borrowing even more money. It's an unorthodox approach, considering deficit spending largely created the mess, and Illinois' worst in the nation credit rating makes borrowing inordinately expensive. However, supporters say it's the best way to begin to erase $14.6 billion in overdue payments to vendors and service providers. Bills that are 90 or more days past due incur 12% in late payment fees. By paying off a chunk of that at a time with the sale of bond proceeds, the state could cut that rate in half. We are being smothered by our liability and our indebtedness, not only in the state, and trying to deal with the budget, but with the people we owe money, said Democratic Senator Donnie Trotter of Chicago, the assistant majority leader who sponsored the measure. Trotter said it currently takes Illinois about 200 days to pay a bill, but his plan would reduce that to as few as 60 days. The Democratic-controlled General Assembly endorsed the budget and a $6 billion borrowing scheme over Republican Governor Bruce Rauner's vetoes. However, it's unclear whether Rauner will actually use the borrowing authority given to him. He has said nothing about it in the 10 days since the budget was passed, and his spokeswoman, Eleni Demirtas, declined comment Thursday. It's typically advisable for governments to borrow for long-term construction projects only. But analysts say for Illinois, it's a sound way to get ahead of its crisis instead of letting it fester. Illinois' problems are entirely a matter of politics and willingness, said Matt Fabian, a partner at Municipal Market Analytics. The state has had the ability to fix its budget and remedy its long-term liability. It's just chosen not to for all these years. Creditors don't object. If the state came to me and said, we'll pay you all the back pay at one time, but you won't get the late payment interest, I'd be happy with that, said Ken White, owner of Above and Beyond Cleaning Specialist, which maintains several downtown Springfield Capitol Complex buildings and is owed up to $200,000. Bond rating houses have reacted favorably to Illinois' financial plan, if not to the idea of borrowing specifically. Three major agencies threatened a downgrade of the Prairie State's creditworthiness to junk status without a swift remedy, but published positive messages since budget action July 6th. And the next is an article with the headline, Illinois has a budget, so now what? It's better to have a spending plan than not, but after 2 years without one, the question remains, is that all there is? The Illinois House of Representatives voted 71-42 on Thursday to override Governor Bruce Rauner's veto of a $36 billion spending plan, financed with a $5 billion income tax increase. Of course, nothing in Illinois happens without some drama attached. The session was delayed about 2 hours after the white powdery substance was thrown at the governor's office. The Capitol was not evacuated, but people were not allowed to enter or exit the building. A hazmat team were called to clean things up. A preliminary analysis shows the substance wasn't hazardous. One woman was arrested. If only hazmat could clean up the situation in the state. We do this or we go to financial meltdown, said Representative Steven Anderson, Republican of Geneva, of the override vote. For the first time in 2 years, Illinois has a budget, while six other states do not. Connecticut, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Oregon, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin missed their budget deadlines. New Jersey and Maine ended partial government shutdowns just in time for the 4th of July. Illinois was expected to raise taxes, and it was no surprise that lawmakers did not deal with the root causes that got the state into the financial hole it is in today. Pensions, still a big problem. Bill backlog, $14.7 billion as of Thursday. Credit rating, not quite junk status. The budget alone does not fix Illinois' financial problems. The good news is that there is a budget, and there were quite a few political pundits who thought there would never be one while Rauner was in office. Schools will open in the fall. Higher education, including community colleges such as Rock Valley College, will get money. Road construction will continue, and social service agencies will be paid. All would have been in jeopardy without a budget. At last. You could use those words as a sigh of relief now that Illinois finally has a full year's state budget. It would be accurate. While a budget hasn't magically removed the numerous issues still plaguing the state, it is the first step toward stability. Businesses, schools, universities, social service agencies, and governments need to know what they have to work with if they are to be successful. That's been lacking for 2 years. And while it's unlikely the new budget includes everything these entities would have liked, it provides a foundation on which they can start rebuilding. But we think that phrase is a more apt description of what we saw from more than a dozen legislators as they cast their votes for the spending and revenue measures that constitute the state's first budget in 2 years. They put the people, instead of their political party, first. Whether their constituents agree with their representatives' votes, and many do not, we have elected representatives to go against their voters to lead for what they thought was best for the people they represent. In the end, 15 House Republicans voted for the income tax increase, with 10 of them voting to override Governor Bruce Rauner's veto. Some House Democrats were reportedly instrumental in making sure the votes were taken. In the Senate, one Republican joined Democrats in approving the hike. Anyone who listened to the proceedings could tell these legislators agonized over their decisions before casting their votes. In the hyper-partisan environment that dominates today's politics, this is a rarity. It takes guts to go against leadership. House Speaker Michael Madigan is also the chairman of the Illinois Democratic Party. In the past, he's run primary opponents against members who have irked him. Rauner provides the lion's share of funding for the state Republican Party. If those 10 to 15 representatives plan to run again, they're going to need support during their next campaign and have risked their party's trust. In our eyes, they traded that for a stronger covenant with the public they represent. We know having to fork over more in income taxes is an unpleasant pill to swallow for us everyday residents. But there should be comfort in knowing there are elected officials who put the needs of the people above the desires of their political party. We've consistently said we need bipartisan compromise if Illinois is ever to resolve its issues. That happened this past week, and it needs to continue if lawmakers are serious about changing the trajectory of the state's future. Here's where Illinois stands now. The stack of unpaid bills is about $14.7 billion. The unfunded pension liability is at least $130 billion. An agreement still needs to be reached on how to fund K-12 education for the academic year that starts in about a month. Property taxes are still among the highest in the nation. A budget did not solve those problems or many others lurking in the background. It wouldn't take much for Illinois to continue to decline. The real work is just beginning. Success will be realized if that willingness to work together and across the aisle continues at all times, not only during a time of crisis. We challenge lawmakers. Be known for your ability to cooperate and compromise instead of always towing the party line. And that's from the Springfield State Journal Register. This has been Lois Pausch reading you the news for Friday, July the 14th, 2017. I look forward to reading with you again soon.